Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Poorly Informed Podcast. This week, I am your host, Max, and I'm joined here by Theo and Peter. Will is not with us today, he has gone on holiday, so next week should be back, but hopefully the three of us won't do too bad on our own. This week we are discussing how far is too far in warfare. So how far should you go in regards to the use of chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, or other methods in order to end a war quickly or just end it in general. So I think that's about it. So Theo, let's go straight in. Theo, what's your view?
I think war is inevitable, right? Humans like a bit of conflict, and conflict will always happen. But we've got to make sure it's clean, it's fair, which sounds a bit funny when I'm talking about people shooting each other's brains out. But there is some, at the end of the day, at the back of your head, you know that you have certain rights, there's certain rules of the game that mean that you can't just play dirty a little bit, really. So conventional warfare, I think, you know, you're talking about Geneva Convention, the Hague Convention, no nasty biological stuff, because that may mean the war takes longer, but it also means a higher regard for the quality of life.
Okay, and Peter?
I sort of hold the opposite opinion. I would like to preface what I say by saying that I do think war is bad and war should be avoided. However, if a war starts, I think it's better to get it done with as quickly as possible. You know, rip the bandage off. Rip the bandage, rip the plaster, you know, get the pain over with. Doesn't really matter how it's done, one side has to win quickly.
Okay, so with that, I think we should start with, what is moral warfare? Like, to what? What would you include as moral and, you know, not going too far, Theo?
We have rules, right?
Yeah.
So there, you have the Hague Conventions, which were created around the turn of the 19th century. And you have the Geneva Conventions, which were a bit later on. And basically they said, you know, you've got to treat prisoners fairly. So treat them as humans. So give them food and adequate shelter, not shoot them. You know, no gas, no, not bombing civilians, which is now so commonplace we barely protest at it. Fair decency, almost. Yes, it's war, and so talking about decency sounds funny, but at the end of the day, even in combat, even in conflict, you should still have regard that these are not simply robots of an enemy state coming at you. They are people, and yes, maybe in this situation you're allowed to kill them, but you should also bear in mind that they suffer pain. And so we should try to minimise that pain where we can while still fighting to win.
I think the rules of war have always interested me as a topic, because in Henry V, which is largely focused around the Battle of Agincourt, there's one scene where I think Henry V complains about the France's acting unsportsmanly, basically because they're attacking the luggage, they're attacking the baggage, which was in European conventional warfare. You didn't attack the horses, you didn't attack the camp followers, you didn't attack like the messenger boys, because they weren't soldiers.
But now in modern warfare, that's seen as smart. You know, if you do that,
yeah,
you're being
it's
clever.
It's essentially attacking supply lines. It wasn't done when there was an actual battle going on. You didn't attack with luggage. But these rules have existed since at least Agincourt.
And you had like battles were quite famous in the Civil War before Oliver Cromwell rocked up. They'd sort of meet in the middle of the field and discuss when they were going to fight, and, you know, draw out sort of the laws of battle. So it was a war game at Eton or Oxford. And then Oliver Cromwell came in with his parliamentarians, his roundheads, and just said, to hell with that. And, you know, had surprise attacks and raids and just fought wherever they saw the cavaliers.
Think so, yeah.
That sounds about right.
The Roundheads and the Cavaliers, but I don't know which side was which.
Okay.
Which side was it?
The Roundheads were pro-Parliament, anti-Charles I, and the Cavaliers were pro-Charles I. So the Roundheads had the sort of steel helmets.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the Cavaliers, if horrible history is anything to go by, had all the sort of fancy clothes and were very good at dancing. But I think that's a horrible history.
Probably. So, Theo, the thing you were saying about how civilian casualties, but surely using, you know, some methods to end the war quickly would lead to less civilian casualties than a prolonged conflict.
Well, if you just say we're not going to kill the civilians, then it makes no impact.
Yeah, but it's inevitable in war that civilians will die.
We'll minimise it by just attempt by not doing it deliberately.
Also, but talking about...
Well, for instance, in Yugoslavia,
yeah.
Okay, for no reason, the Serbs were bombing Bosnians in Kosovo and in... I don't know clearly the... But effectively, everyone was bombing everyone's civilians.
True.
And it didn't hasten the war by anything. It didn't contribute to any increased goodness in the Balkans. People hate each other probably more now. There's long-lasting resentment. If they hadn't just thrown missiles at civilians or sniped them off in the streets, then actually you'd have a lot more goodness knocking around that region.
True.
Oh, yeah, I just want to say, you know...
I've got a point, but I'm an impartial host.
Thanks. So. You know your whole thing of, like, both sides abiding by certain conventions? The problem with that is that it requires both sides to abide by certain conventions. And if you're in a total war with another side, you're risking your own people and yourself by not taking any advantages you can and by not taking the advantage that not abiding by these things will. And you're trusting that the enemy... whose people you're killing every day, who you're having like a pitched combat with.
Well, we've done it until the 1900s. That's just what countries did.
But I think that's because they didn't.
Henry V, the French attacked the luggage. That's what the that's what Shakespeare said.
Well, but by and large, countries did for about 2,000 years play by an unwritten set of ideals as regards, you know, yes. It talks in the Bible and the Quran about sacking towns and killing and raping the citizens. But on a larger scale, by and large, you fought armies and true. Tried to minimise collateral damage.
But I think that's because of the changing nature of warfare recently and the causes of war has been different recently. Now, or at least we say that we go into wars for moral reasons, such as the intervention in the Middle East is because... you know, we want to protect the civilians of those countries because they're being oppressed by their governments or they're being, like, gassed by their governments. We're not going in because, oh, we want this land, so we're going to fight you for this land. We're going in to protect your people. So we're going in for a moral reason because we think, or at least we say, that we think that the other side is not moral. So why should we trust them to not engage in any of these peaceful, sportsmanly rules of warfare if... they're not doing it in peacetime anyway.
Well, I think if you're going to invade a country to overthrow a dictator, then you are required to not be as bad as that dictator. Your point is self-defeating. If you're going in to be a moral force, you still wouldn't... that being the moral force means you would not attack civilians. It doesn't matter what the enemy is going to do. As the invader, as the liberator, you are going to behave better than the nasty guy already there.
But surely... short-term, you know, more casualties of civilians will lead to, in the long-term, better conditions, such as during World War II, with the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the estimates for casualties in Operation Downfall, where they were going to do a land invasion of Japan.
Operation Olympic, I thought it was.
I think Downfall was like the first one.
Okay, my bad.
I'm just doing Wikipedia. basically, April 1945, they're sort of estimates for casualties was between 149,000 casualties, which was, I think it was just like the American 6th Army, so not even the whole, and it was only for the first 6 months or something. So it'd be either 149 to 514,000 American casualties. And then later on, there was a study done for the Secretary of War, which estimated that invading Japan would cost 1.7 million to 4 million American casualties, which would be 400 to 800 fatalities and 5 to 10 million Japanese fatalities, which compared to the 130 to 230 casualties from the atomic bombs, that is over. It's better that the bombs were dropped than an extended land invasion occurred.
That's true, but at the same time, I mean, I'm in two parts. One part of me wants to say, well, actually, in that case, you should say that the atomic bombs are the cleanest way to fight. In fact, that actually, the calculations show that the atomic bomb minimised civilian casualties and was good in ending the war. But another part of me wants to say, well, you know, could you have still not won the war the other way by continuing the blockade of Japan? So we were bombing, well, the Americans more accurately, were bombing Japan continuously, but not having a significant impact. It was a blockade of Japan, intercepting their convoys and merchant marine that was doing the most damage, sustaining that, continuously defeating him in China, wiping out any presence on small islands, maybe that could have achieved the same aim. So there's two ways you can go about that argument. I think, and also the fact the atomic bombs worked, if the atomic bombs still hadn't liberated Japan, we had to invade them anyway, we would be sitting here talking about that that was a costly misjudgment, a costly failure. So I think we're quite lucky that we've got history on our side, and that the emperor personally decided that the atomic bombs meant he needed to surrender. Because where Japan was, these atomic bombs are not always making people surrender.
So you're saying that the more extreme option to end the war quickly was better?
No, I'm saying that there was an option to reduce civilian casualties, clearly and evidently, and they took it. And frankly, I'm glad they took it. Otherwise, the modern world would be very different. But in that circumstance, was the atomic bomb a better way to go than training hundreds of thousands of civilian personnel and nurses to fight with bamboo sticks? Yes. Do you know what I mean? It was better than absolute destruction and death and chaos on the Japanese mainland to drop those two atomic bombs.
I think one of my problems I have with conventions and rules of war, it's not necessarily a problem I have with them, it's a problem that I think they have, is that as society moves on, battles have changed a lot from when they were first drawn up 100 years ago. So, obviously 500 years ago, it was two armies would meet in a field, they'd wear different colours, they'd have different flags, and they'd run at each other. It was quite easy to tell who was who.
With the sort of soundtrack in the background.
Yeah, yeah. In World War One, you had two people on different trenches, shouting at each other in different languages, wearing different uniforms, shooting each other. You knew who was on each side. With World War II, it was the same, maybe to a slightly lesser extent, but as it moves on, most conflicts now are guerrilla conflicts. Who's the civilian? Who's the soldier? Some people are a civilian in like half a day, and then for the other half of the day, they'll turn into a guerrilla soldier. The rules of war and Geneva and conventions about civilians are very hard to look at. And
I think if a civilian is masquerading as a guerrilla soldier, then
a soldier claims to be a civilian, isn't that against the Geneva Convention?
Yeah, I think I think you're right, the conventions are outdated, the rules of the game are outdated. We've got cyber conflict, we've got meddling in elections even when not a war, and we need a new set of Geneva Conventions for the changing game.
How are these supposed to be enforced?
Tribunals, International Criminal Court.
Yeah, but UN. Lots of these sides have done quite a few things which are illegal, terrorism and stuff, but that doesn't stop them.
Nuremberg trials post-war.
Some people believe they are so in the right and believe that what they are doing is right, that they will do, like terrorists, they're, you know, they blow stuff up, sort of suicide bombings and stuff. They do that because they believe they are right and they believe that that's going to make them win. The threat of a military tribunal afterwards isn't going to dissuade them.
It's not, but it's going to deter other other people who commit such atrocities, I think. I think it does have a deterrence effect. I think it does give the victims hope as well, and it encourages them to rebuild their societies if they know that after civil conflict you can have trials that root out the bad eggs, the people who committed atrocities, and move on from that as a country. And I think it's also important in itself that you can serve justice, right? So I think I disagree. I think being able to prosecute and being able to enforce those rules does have an impact, and does for both the victims and the villains. And for people who the terrorists, for jihadists, for people, for anti-vaxxers, right, morons who've convinced themselves they're in the right, that's their own problem. They've allowed themselves to be swayed by false information, to be convinced into something that is inherently and intrinsically wrong.
Okay. Say that in China, hypothetically, that there was a small uprising in a minority province of China, say the Turkish province, right? And then Xi Jinping, the president of China, decides to put it down ruthlessly, and he breaks certain Geneva Conventions as he does so. What's going to happen to him?
I think in an ideal world, hypothetically, of course, none of this would ever happen in real life.
What are you talking about? It hasn't happened.
It's important to stress. Well, I think in an ideal world, other national leaders would criticise that and would say, we're not doing business with you. In an ideal world, I can see you're about to protest, but and say we're not doing business with you unless you stop. And interestingly, because the rules of the game are there, because Western media know that what they're doing is legally wrong and morally wrong, they have been free and they have been encouraged to criticise. And it has brought about minor reversals, beginning to see a little bit of change. Employees at Western companies are protesting and stopping American firms from operating in China or in Xinjiang province because they know that they're doing horrible things to the hypothetical Chinese Turkic people.
What I mean is that what I really want to say is it seems like justice is only given to people who lose. Or and these sort of tribunals, there's often a complaint thrown at the European, what is it, the International Criminal Court, is that they only take on African dictators or dictators of small nations, and they never look at problems from, for example, America or from European nations or from China, because or Russia even, because those countries are too big. They won't have an effect. You can't prosecute Xi Jinping. America said if anyone tries to prosecute American soldiers for their actions in Afghanistan, they would just leave or something. So they don't prosecute American. This seems like it's subjective justice only given out to small countries.
It's better than no justice, right? Like, if some African dictators are being prosecuted for doing wrong, that's better than no African dictators being prosecuted for doing wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And the fact that those laws are there means that, you know, it gives the African Union a mandate to criticise dictators and to attack with coup d'etats and I see your frustration is there, and you know, I think all of us have a right to be angry at the fact that these courts often don't work, that these rules are often ineffective, but at the same time, isn't a little good better than no good?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Yeah. And isn't in the framework is still there for future good to happen. So you make a valid point, but it's also a flawed point, because you know, no holds barred warfare, what good does that do?
Mm-hmm.
Right, it just mean endless human misery and endless human suffering, because people would just keep bombing their own people and keep gassing their own people and keep experimenting on bio warfare and cyber warfare on their own people. It would just, there'd be no boundaries, no limits, because the wars don't end when there's a ceasefire or a treaty, they always flare up again. You like Bismarck, okay, you know, 40 years of Franco-German tensions, right? Just because the Franco-Prussian War ended in a treaty, which you would say wasn't that harsh, did it stop conflict between the two? No.
Biggest reparations compared to GDP ever, or that was ever paid off.
Okay, so moving on to World War One, and I
just like this debate has moved away from how far should you go to when the international law was.
I feel like I brought it back.
You were talking a lot about in an ideal world, but in an ideal world there would be no war.
Realistically, let's look at World War One. In World War One, you are Germany. Let's say we're all role playing as Germany, right? We are Austria.
Like his dream, you know.
Austria is
give him a nice hat and a moustache.
Has declared war on Serbia, and Russia has declared war on Austria, and we have to help Austria. I mean, we don't have to. We have chosen to honour our alliance and help Austria, and we know that France has also declared war on Austria, so we're at war with France and we're at war with Russia. So if you're in charge of Germany, you have to win. If you're going to war, you have to win the war. Someone has to win the war, and you want it to be your side to win the war, right?
Or else you've just thrown away all your people's lives.
Otherwise, you're just sinking a cost, and you're getting nothing back, and you're being punished for it. So you have to win a war once you start a war. If you're Germany, the only way you can win the war is to knock out France quickly and then fight Russia. So that's what they tried to do. They did the von Schlieffen plan. Obviously, it was an ill-fated attempt to go through Belgium.
What's your point?
I'm saying that broke international law. Belgium's a neutral country. They weren't at war with Germany. Germany invaded them, but it was the best option for them to do. They had to try and win the war quickly. if Germany had won against France really quickly, there would have been less deaths in World War One.
Because it wouldn't have been bogged down in trench warfare.
It wouldn't have bogged... Yeah, in Belgium, it devolved into 4 years of just meat grinder instead of a couple quick, clean battles.
Well, it shows, therefore, that the shortcuts don't work. Because they banked on Britain not being involved. And Britain was, did get involved.
Germany's only option.
No, it wasn't. Germany had several options, one of which was to not fight at all.
Okay, but once the war has started, Germany has to win the war. And the best way for them to win the war is to break international law.
Well, wasn't the von Schlieffen plan focused on them knocking out Russia?
It was to knock out France to knock out Russia.
Alternatively, they probably could have knocked out Russia. We know they had the capacity to do so.
Because a two-front war goes really well.
Yeah, and it's really easy to quickly knock out well, Russia. Quickly march through the Russian plain.
Yeah, that hasn't gone wrong for anyone ever.
The thing was, to knock out Russia, they would have had to take Moscow, St. Petersburg, possibly Nizhny Novgorod.
No, they wouldn't have had to take Moscow. They could have just taken St. Petersburg, because that was the capital at the time.
They would have moved the capital. They could have moved the capital. There's a lot of fallback land in Russia.
And also, in Russia, capturing the capital doesn't always, you know, it doesn't always guarantee a win. Look at Napoleon. He captured Moscow. The Russians just burnt it down.
Burnt a little bit of it down. He got distracted and then sent his army out.
He got distracted. He went all the way, won the battle, got Moscow, just burned it down. It's like, oh, what am I here for? So he had to go home.
Like, no, he didn't. There was a room in Moscow for his army to be accommodated. But anyway, but that didn't work. And if you look through history, cheating and gassing and doesn't always work. In fact, in the long run,
poisonous gas in World War One was pretty ineffective towards the end because they built gas masks and there were defences against it. So it just became another version of artillery. Like, you know, it was same as artillery.
Atomic bombs blew up Nagasaki and Hiroshima. 20 years later, Japan's economy was decimating the United States by outbuilding, outconstructing, improving technologically. Right? You can use these big weapons. You can use these disgusting means of winning a war, but in the long run, they don't work. The Soviet Union was one of probably the most evil, cruel competitors in World War II. Right? Possibly even more so than Germany, if we take out Germany's domestic affairs with the Holocaust and with the persecution of its own people. Absolutely, you know, we can't even begin to articulate how horrible the Soviet Union waged war and the Soviet Union's collapse. It's dissolved because states that feel the need to play dirty, to, you know, kick and bite and scratch in war, don't always last.
But Japan was pretty horrific in World War II. You know, the whole rape of Nanking, all the horrific war crimes they committed in China.
And the whole thing
you were saying about Japan being successful after, that's because it was a very different country to what it was before. It was the fact that, as opposed to World War One, where we just imposed all the Treaty of Versailles on Germany, after World War Two, we actually went into Japan and took a role in building it up.
Are you forgetting that we did wipe out most of Japan's civilian and national infrastructure in the three most devastating bombings in World War Two: the bombing of Tokyo, when 80,000 people died in one night, and then the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, when 56,000 people died respectively.
But it worked. Ended the war, and less people died.
Well, yeah, so that's what I'm saying. Japan didn't play fair and then didn't win. Mm. But then at the same time, the United States didn't play entirely fair and they didn't entirely win either.
They did win.
Well, they won the war, but as I say, economically, Japan, you could almost say Japan got its own back.
Yeah, but now Japan.
I don't mind a country doing well economically.
Well, I'm saying I reckon a lot of that. The Americans came in, okay, they bombed them to the core. Japan then saw America as the role model to beat and then out role modeled the United States. I'm saying there's something going on that I think you can link the two. I think you can link Japan being bombed to death and Japan, you know, just
coming back as a very different country, because the bombings told them and signaled them, hey, we're not being very good here.
Okay, well, let's change and be good.
I'm saying World War II, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. We convinced the bad guys to be the good guys. You're not challenging my point.
Because
you're saying that because they used this extreme measure, won the war, and led to a better outcome in the end, so therefore you should take any option you can to win a war quickly.
No, I'm saying you can look at both Japan's perspective and the United States' perspective. Playing dirty didn't work. Mm. Japan played dirty in World War World War II. Okay, they took American soldiers, American prisoners of war, experimented on them biologically, injected things like anthrax and the bubonic plague into them to see what would... in the end, we know Japan didn't win. Okay, they played dirty and didn't win. At the same time, America wiped out, and I realise this is contradicting my earlier argument to some extent, America wiped out hundreds of, tens of thousands of people with the atomic bombs, and they didn't entirely win either. And I'm saying, yeah, the atomic bombs led to Japan's economic
revival. I would say that
revival.
America did entirely win. America got to go into Japan and impose an American-style constitution on
which
Japan
then,
and make it an American ally.
Well, because they dropped two atomic bombs on Japan,
yeah.
Which ended up resulting... and because they were able to impose constitution and make them an ally, that ended up allowing Japan's economy to overtake the United States and flatten cities like Detroit and strip them of its car industry because Japan was able to do better.
And now Japan is one of the countries with the most debt in the world.
Like, it's still the third biggest economy in the world. And there are jobs in Japan that are never going back to America.
True.
I don't think that matters, though. I think that's something...
I think it does. I think
but
all
if
of
the
these
war
events
had dragged,
are linked.
If the war had dragged on, because America fought fair and did a prolonged land invasion, which estimates were that it would take 100,000 American reinforcements a month to sustain a land invasion, which isn't sustainable, would lead to mass decimation. You know how... what's the word? Persevering the Japanese were. Like, in fact, you have those people on the islands who were still thought they were fighting in like the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah, no.
So if you had to deal with that sort of ideology and that mindset invading the whole country, it wouldn't have worked. And there would have been this prolonged suffering. It would have been worse in the long term for everyone.
I agree. I'm just flim-flamming between my opinions. So earlier I said the atomic bombs were technically a clean way of fighting, and now I'm saying the atomic bombs were wrong. I'm just throwing up the contrary points of view.
So,
I'm being reactionary.
Yeah.
Here.
So I'm gonna case you here. So if the atomic bombs are a fair way of fighting, because it did shorten the war, how far is too far then? Where would you draw the line of this isn't good, we shouldn't do this, even if it means we win the war quicker?
I think we could say the atomic bombs were a relative necessity. The toll on the toll on American military might was so great, and American civilian capacity was so great that the atomic bombs were effectively the only means of ending the war on a sustainable level. Yeah. Therefore, in that context, you can say, I think the atomic bombs are... You can maybe file them under... It's open for debate, but you can maybe file them under clean warfare.
I would disagree.
The gas warfare in World War One. I'm going to keep talking. The gas warfare in World War One. No, because that caused an intense amount of human suffering, personal human suffering. You know, we're not talking about tens of thousands dying instantly. We're talking about hundreds being, you know, choking on their own lung fluid to death. Did it break the deadlock? No. Was it a cruel and inhumane way to fight a war? Yes. Did it come to anything? No. Was it breaking the laws of the game? Yes. Okay, in that case, gas is not... In fact, I'm going to say gas is never okay. It wasn't a necessity. Okay, the gas was not going to break the front line,
I'll
right?
Agree with you there. I want to ask you, Theo, if you were Germany in World War One, what would you do? You had to fight. You have to fight France.
So I'm in, 1914, 15?
Yeah, so Russia's mobilising, France is mobilising, you're at war with both France
I
and Russia.
I invent tanks.
Because you can't just sit there.
Well, I can, I've invented tanks.
You can't.
I'm literally sitting in the tank.
No, you... Realistically, you can't just sit on your borders and
have I know that.
Prolonged trench warfare with France and Russia, because that's what ended up happening and it didn't work. You have to win the war.
You have to break... No, I understand that. You have to break the deadlock. And are there better ways of doing it? Are you saying that we should have used gas warfare?
No, I don't think that would... That,
however, if gas warfare was effective and did result in Germany knocking us and France out of the war, would that change the opinion? Is it only too far if it doesn't succeed?
I think that's a good question. It's also an impossible question. Like, how am I meant to know? I would like to believe that I would be anti-gas warfare in all circumstances. But, you know, how can I say that? I don't know if I could look myself in the eye. That would be weird. I don't know if I could look myself in the eye and say I still hold to that belief. I think you're right. I think it does depend on what happened, what outcome it is. So what are you saying, what could the Germans have done that would have been okay then, Peter?
I think they had to break the law and they had to invade Belgium. I mean, it sounds bad, poor Belgium, but...
It's because you're a Kaiserboo, aren't you?
No, I think if you look at America and how what America's done in the Middle East recently, have any of those been short, successful wars?
No.
None of them have been short and successful.
However, they've also been pretty... illegal?
They've been legal.
Stats on this.
But they've changed... Afghanistan, nothing has changed. The situation is as bad as it was, or if not worse.
I think you meant they were moral about how they went about it. They were just also incompetent. I think that's not entirely a question of clean, dirty warfare. It is just incompetence.
Is incompetence and the fact they weren't committing that much to win, I would say. Like, I mean, I know trillions of dollars have been spent, but it wasn't... They didn't... America could have done more. They could have won without... having to think if they had a World War II type mentality.
You're basically saying that Iraq and Afghanistan were just sort of...
No, I don't think they should have gone into Iraq or Afghanistan, but when the way they did and the fact that they went in and they did a half-finished job has just led to more problems.
So what are you saying? What's your point?
I'm saying that, like... if they wanted to win those wars, they should have won them properly.
What, and fought dirty?
And fought with an intention to win them more than they had.
So fought dirty?
No, I don't want to say that.
But couldn't you argue that drone strikes is fighting dirty? Because their effectiveness is debatable. Because I did this research, and I want to shoehorn it in somehow.
Yeah.
So out of 6,786 confirmed strikes, there are 8,500 to 12,000 people were killed. And of these, 700 to 1,700 were civilians, and 250 to 400 were children.
Well, that's right, and that's also wrong, because the Pentagon doesn't actually know how many civilians its drone strikes have killed. Presumably that's a third-party website.
True.
Yeah, so there are organisations which have pretty good statistics. But that shows the American government itself doesn't pay attention to its drone strikes. So Obama imposed laws that meant drone strikes had to be checked with another group, humanitarian group, to make sure it didn't kill civilians, and that was moderately successful. And the Trump administration, guess what the Trump administration did? Got rid of the laws, and that's why we're now seeing an increase in the number of civilians going kaboom because of American drones. I would say that's illegal. I would say that's unfair. I'd say that is actually dirty warfare, because you're not respecting sovereignty, you're not respecting independence, you're flying into other nations and just going poof. And if you're gonna try and solve a country's problems, as Peter says, you've got to commit and you've got to send people there and help out, not just sort of fly drones around and make the locals even angrier and more anti-American.
Slightly on a tangent, do you think warfare will devolve into fully drone warfare soon?
I want space drone warfare. That's what I want. But I don't think it will, because there's very little cost. There is cost. It's purely a monetary cost. There's no human cost. So there's very little motive to stop fighting if you can still afford it.
Well, presumably, as soon as drones become the front line of warfare for most countries, I mean, only America can really... America, Russia and China are the only countries that can consider it seriously at this point.
But yeah.
Presumably, anti-drone warfare will catch up.
Well, I suppose, but what I'm thinking is, if, for example, America, Russia and China have the capability of doing full-scale drone warfare, where they essentially will suffer zero consequences for it, what's to stop them from just going to Guyana and saying, we've got a drone army, where's your drone army?
Well, nothing to stop them, and that's why I'm saying we should go by the rules. Do you see the point? Do you see the problem with your argument here? You're basically saying that they can do that because it's a clean... If they want to invade a sovereign country using drones, they sure as hell can, and they sure as hell will. Okay, if there are rules that every country goes by, then Guyana isn't going to be invaded by drones.
But who's going to stop and enforce the rules? I don't think the rules are enforceable in war very easily.
Ultron, a suit of armour around the world.
I think the best...
Peace in our time.
I think the best way to have wars is to not have them, and then if you do have them,
Because going all out on a war is, you know, that is going to be such a disincentive. If dictators see that going all out on a war for their neighbour goes all out on a war and wins, then they're just going to go all out on a war and win as well. It's just going to incentivise more war.
Is it?
Yeah.
When they think, oh, damn, these people went all out on a war. I don't want to go to a war because they'll go all out on me.
Yeah, because dictators are really good at thinking through those sort of questions.
And no, I think all conflict should be solved by a game of rock, paper, scissors.
What?
Like, pretty bloodless, right? Like,
the whole hotkey, just imagine if war is rock, paper, scissors, right? Everyone did this when they were kids, you know? Rock, paper, scissors, dynamite. Dynamite beats everything, you're guaranteed to win.
It's also illegal. Like, the UN moderator will just come and punch
you. Yeah, so
the
UN is against using dynamite. However, dynamite has still led to you winning, and you have still won for your side, which you believe is moral, which you believe is better for your people.
Yeah, but the other side can just not accept it, and then you've got a conflict.
And it also prevents It prevents a, you know, long drawn out thing where you go rock, paper, scissors and you always draw. And that is that's a painful conflict on your wrist. The long term damage on your wrist from extended rock, paper, scissors.
Can you imagine trying to get like 200 countries to agree on whether you should go rock, paper, scissors, go or rock, paper, scissors?
It's rock, paper, scissors.
No, it's rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
No, it's not. You don't do that. No, it's rock, paper, scissors.
Rock, paper, scissors. No, you see? It's not rock, paper, scissors. You need more thinking time.
No, you don't.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
The whole thing is that it is abrupt. Like, war is abrupt and brash, so is rock, paper,
scissors. War is not abrupt. Right, should we do a quick rock, paper, scissors?
Let's bring
it back
to the
question. We can do rock, paper, scissors to decide who wins this argument.
Could do, yeah. Mm. Let's bring it back to the question. How far is too far? Where would you draw the line? So, is it just on whether it works? Or is it on whether it ends the war quicker?
There are more important things than whether you win the war. If you lose...
If you're in a war, you have to win the war.
Not when you're in the middle of a war, but in general, there are more important things than winning a conflict, right? In the 2,000 years of history, what's better? Okay, humans being decent and upholding an international community because they play by the rules, or humans cannibalising each other through unbridled, destructive conflict?
Historically, 2,000 years ago, for most of human history, the factors of production have always been pretty much the same. Like, there's been a set amount of food grown in the world. And for a country to increase the amount of food it grows, the only way for it to do that is to take more land. So historically, if you wanted more food, you had to take more land. You couldn't peacefully and internally grow your country. It wasn't really a viable option. So historically, conflict has always been the best way to make your country prosper.
No, I realise that, but I suppose what I'm really saying is, today we have a world order, or more accurately, 10 years ago we had a world order where you had organisations like the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, the EU, and people, there are rules governing those organisations, and people go by, especially with the World Trade Organization, people go by the rules, and disputes are sorted fairly, and trade is sorted fairly. You don't have dumping, you don't have predatory pricing, you don't have undercutting other economies. And that world order is beginning to break down. The rules are not being paid attention to. China is breaking the rules. The United States is breaking those rules. With 7 billion people living on the planet, we can't risk those organisations just collapsing. The only reason standard of living is so good in the world today is because of those organisations. If we just had awful trade warfare post-war, would we be living in this nice 7-8-room house today with a front lawn, a back lawn, sofas, comfy chairs, nice cheap clothing? You drive your own car. I mean, it's pretty rubbish, but you do drive your own car.
Okay, I'm not sure you can call it driving.
So neither of you have passed your tests. So.
That's true. You're wearing a Levi t-shirt. You're wearing Adidas tracksuits. I'm wearing Primark jeans. Right. Everything we see around us is because of a rules-based order established post-war. If you break down the rules, you get chaos and you get disruption to a standard of living. Are you trying to tell me that less rules is going to be better and quicker and cleaner?
Well, we're not talking about there not being any wars and any rules in warfare. We're talking about, should you break the rules to win?
He's saying everything to win at all costs.
Well, he just wants Germany to have won World War One. That's all he wants.
I would say that rules and trade and in international relations are different.
It amounts to the same thing. It's international cooperation. It's international respect for the rule of law.
You make a good point. But
I know.
If you're in charge, you're very proud of your point, aren't you? I think if you're in charge of a country, your first job as leader of a country is to protect your people. And it, I think that supersedes any other obligations you may have.
But can you say
for the most part, protecting your people involves following the international rules of law.
You beat me by 10 seconds.
It involves following the World Trade Organization's rules of like trade. It involves following what the UN says. These all protect your people and benefit your people to the most, to the highest level. However, I would say that once a war starts and your people start dying and they start getting shot in the streets, then that those rules can be superseded by what you could do to end that.
But you don't show your humanity and you don't show the metal of your people by being nice in the good times. Like you show your character as an individual, you show your character and your strength and personality in the bad times. Like a country can easily follow the laws in the good times. It's in a conflict, it's when under stress, it's when under economic duress, that's when you see how much commitment there is to the rules. In fact, in war, you are more obliged to follow the rules, and you are more obliged to follow the rules of the game than in peacetime, because there is more at stake, and there is more resting on it. If you don't follow the rules, you set a precedent, and suddenly you've got dominoes falling, okay, and the rules-based global order is vulnerable.
So I don't disagree with you, I just think that, and yeah, I would like your system to exist. However, I feel like I can understand with and empathise with the notion of people not following that to achieve.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, would the world be a better place if they did?
No,
if they did,
the world will be a worse place
if
doing
did,
this.
If they did respect prisoners of war, if they did treat civilians fairly, if they didn't.
An extra however many million people would have died just in the invasion of Japan. I'm going to keep them at this.
You've not said anything for 10 minutes, you can keep it that way.
Would it be a mistake for me to bring up Vietnam if you do it in history?
Oh, we haven't done it this year, so it's fine.
Okay.
But I am reading a massive book on it at the moment.
You will know more about Vietnam than both of us.
We can make things up. America went into Vietnam with good intentions to stop it falling to communism, to attempt to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese civilians, right?
No.
Did
America
that
went into, America went into Vietnam with good intentions to stop communism, but not really to win the hearts and minds of Vietnamese people.
I'm sure
they
I learned
up,
about hearts
they,
and minds of
the
11 history.
They knowingly propped up a terrible dictator and then inspired coups against him and then inspired coups against his successor, and inspire coups against his successor's successor. So, not really, from the start, they were pretty useless and they were pretty immoral in the way they behaved in Vietnam.
True, but the you could also argue the Viet Cong were pretty immoral in their use of guerrilla tactics, you know, pretending to be civilians, which is,
sure,
as you said, against the rules of warfare.
But did Americans using napalm and strafing innocent citizens then encourage civilians to join the Viet Cong and swell their ranks?
True, it would have.
The Viet Cong
were
taking heavy casualties before America committed to entering the war.
True. But are we just saying that because it failed to win in the war? If napalm and Agent Orange and all the other stuff, if it had been successful, would we be arguing right now that it was a bad example?
I think it comes down to a question of, was it a necessity? Did it increase or decrease casualties? Maybe it would have helped the Americans to win, but the toll on Vietnam would be catastrophic.
True. Well, even now, Vietnam is probably one of the most successful. It's still communist, isn't it?
Socialist.
Yeah, one of the most successful socialist states, especially in Asia.
Yeah.
And probably it's one of the most successful Asian countries, if you know, if you ignore China and Japan.
Will missed a trick not talking about it 2 weeks ago.
So that brings back to the point you were making about Japan earlier, about how after the war they were successful and whether it was as a result of all these war crimes or not. I don't know where this point is going.
I don't know, I feel like I would like everywhere to respect all the rules all the time. However, in most examples of warfare I can think of, at least one or more of the sides is not respecting the rules. And then if one side is not respecting the rules, why are you giving them this advantage, this edge against you? Can you name a war, or like a modern war, where both sides have respected the rules of engagement? World War One, no. World War Two, no.
Falklands War?
Boer War, no.
You could argue the Falklands, but was that really a war?
It wasn't much of it. And didn't we assume things outside the zone?
We sank the Belgrano outside the exclusion zone.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I personally would condemn that. I would say that was unnecessary.
It was unnecessary because there was no way we could lose, was the whole thing. Like the Argentinian soldiers would get captured on purpose so they could get fed.
That's an exaggeration. They had really effective Argentine Air Force was very effective in sinking our ships. But if we hadn't had Harrier air cover with our aircraft carriers, we would have been. So actually, it was touch and go.
If we didn't have this one thing that was useful, we wouldn't have lost. But what I'm saying
is, General Belgrano, on the one hand, sinking it outside the exclusion zone meant that the Argentine Navy fled and allowed the British to make a landing. On the other hand, it was outside the exclusion zone. We set up the rules and then we broke them. And I'm just going to say here and now that it was not good.
But surely setting up the rules and then breaking them allowed the war to end sooner and with less casualties. So how many people died in the Falklands War?
Not many, but not many. Lots more ships would have sunk if the Falklands Navy hadn't left at that point.
It's
hard to say because we don't know what could have happened.
And you also don't want to make soldiers' lives pawns in this. And there was, I don't want to say that actually a lot of people died for nothing or more people should have died or whatever.
I think the whole war was pretty pointless.
Yeah.
It was over an island with sheep on it.
But yes, I can't think of any wars without one side breaking the rules. If one side's breaking the rules, you shouldn't have them have an advantage over your side.
And that is a good closing statement from Peter. Theo, I will give you two sentences to summarise your points, and I'll give Peter another sentence.
Play by the rules, because it works.
I hoped Theo would save stuff for longer so I could try and think of something pithy to end on. I don't know, I don't really have anything else to say. War is bad.
Okay, yeah, war is bad. We haven't come to a consensus, but when do we ever
come to a consensus?
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot, right?
No, Max is the impartial host. It's me versus you. Okay.
So rock, paper, and you go on scissors.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
No!
Yes! Theo wins.
There you go. You should always try moral warfare, even though we haven't decided where moral warfare lies. There you go. Think about that one. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you enjoyed the next episode as well. Not sure what it's on yet, but when it comes out, that's when you'll know. So, anything else? Follow the Instagram and Twitter at @podcastpoorly. Give us an email at
poorlyinformeddiscussion@gmail.com. No one does check the email to answer your question. No one does email us. I've not checked for a while. I think we get stuff from WordPress.
We got a junk email the other day from some woman in like Nigeria.
Yeah, we get quite a lot of junk emails actually.
I don't know who's been giving out our email, but
we'll put them on the Twitter.
Big shout out.
We release it every week on the internet.
Oh yeah, it's probably us, isn't it?
Big shout out to those Californian listeners.
Oh yeah, thank you for listening from California.
On the one hand, it's either one of you listening to all our episodes twice, or there's 42 of you, 52 of you.
Who've listened to one episode and decided they hated it. Whichever one it is, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And with that, we will see you, let you hear us speak to you next time.